WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Russell Simmons, is perhaps the most famous and successful hip-hop entrepreneur. He started off producing rap shows in 1976. He managed Curtis Blow, who had one of the first rap hits, Christmas Rapping. In 1985, Simmons co-founded Def Jam Records, which signed such artists as LL Cool J, The Beastie Boys, The Fresh Prince, and Public Enemy. Simmons produced the movies The Nutty Professor and How to Be a Player and the HBO TV series Def Comedy Jam, and he has his own clothing and accessories line called Fat Farm. Russell Simmons tells his story in his new memoir, Life and Def, which was written with Nelson George. I asked Simmons what his reaction was in 1979 when he heard this, the first commercial rap record, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang.
The hip, 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 hop, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, bubble to the boogity, bang, bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat.
And me, 1979, that record came out, and I was very distraught because I didn't know any better, and I had a record on the shelf by the name of Christmas Rapping, which was the first release that I was involved with by Curtis Blow. And so, you know, I didn't have the vision to know that this was an eye-opener for America or opened the door for me. I just thought that these guys had stolen my, you know, not my idea, but I had a record on the shelf, and I wanted it to be the first rap record. So when I heard it, I kind of, not only was I upset, but so was the whole hip-hop community, because there was a group of artists, DJ Hollywood, Eddie Chiba, the great Grandmaster Flash, Curtis Blow, Lovebug Starsky. These guys were the stars of that genre, and they were performing artists. Now, here's a recording artist record by people who were not popular, who borrowed ideas and rhymes from this community and put it on record. So we were all, like, bummed out because we thought these guys had stolen our music, our ideas, and our, you know, our culture, and they were selling it, and we weren't. So I didn't realize that Rapper's Delight was the greatest thing that could have happened to me.
How was it the greatest thing?
Well, because it allowed people to understand that there was profit in rap music. And then it gave Curtis Blow an opportunity to put out his record. I had a Curtis Blow record on the shelf. Again, that record was named Christmas Rapping. It plays every Christmas right now.
Why don't we play it now? Introduce it for us. Tell us something about what you think made this record special.
Well, it was probably the second rap record to come out, and it was, you know, a very, very commercial version of hip-hop, but it certainly it was honest. It was a hip-hopper who was from Harlem. It was the real thing and had built a legitimate following on his own as a performing artist, and it was actually very timely, and every Christmas it's still timely. You know, it's pretty interesting rhymes, whenever I hear it, I get goosebumps because that was my first experience of being in the record business, which was something, of course, I aspired to and, you know, only dreamed about.
Okay, so this is Christmas Rapping. It's Russell Simmons' first record production and Curtis Blow's first recording.
"'Twas the night before Christmas and all through the
house." Hold it now, wait, hold it. That's played out. Hit it! "You give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive. 'Cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know. So every year, just about this time, I celebrate it with a rhyme. Gonna shake it, gonna bake it, gonna make it good. Gonna rock, shock, knock it through your neighborhood. Gonna read, gonna sing it till it's understood. My rapping about to happen like a knee you were slapping, or a toe you've been tapping on a hunk of wood. Bought a red suited dude with a friendly attitude and a sleigh full of goodies for the people on the block. Got a long white beard, maybe looks kinda weird, and if you ever see him, he can give you quite a shock."
That's Curtis Blow's Christmas Rapping, produced by my guest Russell Simmons, who has a new memoir, which is called Life and Death. Now, when you started getting successful, and when some of the performers you were producing, like Curtis Blow, started getting successful, Run DMC, it meant money. Making money quickly at a young age can be a very good thing. It could also be a very destructive thing, because sometimes people aren't prepared to deal with that kind of money, and it gets them into more trouble than it has benefits. Looking back, what are some of the things you think you did right and wrong when you started coming into money?
Well, I think that I already was like a big old druggie. Like whatever drug came my way, I took. I was already running the street. The success or the money, the results of the success, I don't think it damaged me too much. You know, I mean, it gave me opportunity and access. Some of the access was a little bit of a problem. But I think that mostly I had a good time, and I think that the money for me was, you know, just gave me more incentive in a way. It was kind of a measure of success. But I did see many artists who got addicted to drugs and whose careers suffered because of this quick access and this amount of money that was, you know, for them an unreasonable amount of money for the work that they did. People did the work for the love of it, and when they started to get a lot of money for it, they lost focus, many of us. And so, at some point, you know, I just straightened up, and it was kind of an evolution, but it was just, I don't think that the money for me was a problem. I mean, it gave me the opportunity to get an apartment. I remember when Christmas Rapping was a hit, for instance, the greatest success that I can remember to date is that I got a record out. I got a chance to get on a plane and go to Amsterdam, which for me was an amazing experience. I had never been on a plane at all. I went to Amsterdam in 1979 with Curtis Blow. We were treated like, well, we thought we were kings. We got to go to Amsterdam and perform, and we saw people, you know, from other countries, not only Amsterdam, but we went to France, Paris, France specifically, and these people watched us perform, and here we were in this big world with our own music. And when I came back to New York, I was moving into my own apartment. That apartment is probably no bigger than the studios I'm here recording from. But I was in the record business, which is what I wanted to be, and that was a tremendous success, just the ability to go to work every day in an industry that I loved.
As a teenager, you were dealing drugs and making money that way. Did you learn anything in the business of dealing drugs that you were able to apply when you became a real businessman?
Well, I can tell you that it inspired me to buy for one and sell for two. And that's something that in the black community, we didn't have very many role models who are entrepreneurs. It's just now that hip-hop is inspiring so many young people, many of whom are not so educated or sophisticated, but are driven by incentive and, I mean, by love of music and art, and who own their own. And there are big margins in some of these businesses, and they just go to work every day without, you know, a business school background, without a degree from Harvard or wherever, to just go to work from heart. It's something that was not instilled in kids in the black community. Their job was to be a doctor, maybe, but be a teacher, probably. Just to go to school was the goal. You know, rappers rap now about being CEOs. They don't even rap sometimes about how good a rapper they are. They rap a lot more about how much they can stack money and how they do it. You know, how they run their businesses.
Now, do you think of yourself as having done business any differently with Def Jam than you saw business being done in the major record labels that you had tried to deal with?
Absolutely. We had this vision that these artists were long-term, that they had images of that had to be protected, that they were not going to be exploitative in terms of the kind of music they put out. We weren't going to change their music so it would sell more. We weren't going to sell them out or allow them to sell themselves out. We wanted to remind them to keep their integrity and promote that. We wanted to make sure that their images, their visual images, were out in the street, not just their music. There was a lot of work that we did that was different from what major labels would have done, and it gave us an edge over them, because even now, LL Cool J, who was our first act, and we recorded his record in 84, is recording a new record, and his last record was a platinum-selling record. Even now, there's a new Run-DMC record being recorded, and their first record was recorded in 1982. Beastie Boys are still recording. There's a new Public Enemy record. Slick Rick is still coming out. There's a new EPMD record. These are the bands we started with. You can always fool people one time or a few times, but to really have a long-standing career, you have to connect with them in some real place.
My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He has a new memoir called Life and Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He co-founded Def Jam Records, has produced movies and TV shows, and created the clothing and accessories company Fat Farm. Have you ever been concerned about the promotion of a gangster lifestyle through rap, making it cool to think of women as bitches, making it cool to think of, shooting people in drive-bys and the gang life?
You know, I'm often asked this question.
I figured. And,
and people are always surprised to know that I'm really proud of all of what rap stands for today. And I believe that what people say in their closed doors, they're shocked to hear it on the radio. They're shocked to hear a reflection of this reality, broadcast. I heard a senator say at the hearings on the Marketing Accountability Act, and Senator Thompson, a Republican senator, said he thought that every 15-year-old boy should see Saving Private Ryan, because he thought that if they all saw that, they'd know a lot about the war and about, that lifestyle that you have to, or that attitude that you have to have in order to live through war, and it was important. And I said, well, in that case, every 15-year-old kid must hear a Snoop Dogg record, because that's a war going on down the block. And that's not 50 years ago, that's right now. And that's something that it's very important. When they say F the police, or when they said it in Compton in 1985, that was such an important record. I remember signing a band in L.A., and they were just nice kids, basically, but lived in a horrible part of L.A. And they came to visit me at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they asked me how to get home. I said, what do you mean, how do you get home? How'd you? And I said, they're afraid of the police. I said, well, why are you afraid of the police? What are you carrying? Do you have guns? Do you have drugs? No, we don't have anything. We're just afraid of police. He's a 20-year-old man, scared to drive in Beverly Hills. Almost all the records that people perceive as gangster records are about people frustrated who don't perceive themselves as having any other opportunity, and it's a description of their lifestyle more than it is an endorsement of it. And so that's something that, people who listen closely to the music can tell. And people from the outside, all they can hear is the language. Well, real language is okay by me. And descriptions of real situations and a real reflection of our society, a part of our society, is important by me.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think at the same time, though, all of that became a kind of style. And it was a style that was equated with being authentic. So if you wanted to make a record and sound authentic, you had to do it in that style, too, even if it wasn't really your style.
My brother's a Reverend Run. His record's his last hit, he hadn't made a hit in about 5-7 years. It was called Down With The King. It's about down with God. LL Cool J has never made a gangster record. DMX talks about heart and soul. Jay-Z talks about the street, but he also talks about how could he ever survive getting out of it. And how could he talks about how happy he is and thrilled anybody should be. And and Will Smith, I think, is the biggest rapper in the world. Lauryn Hill may be the second biggest rapper in the world. They're not gangsters. I think that people make more, it's more newsworthy, but not salesworthy always. So you may talk about gangster rap because it offends you. But I think there's a lot of good in even those records, but there is a good balance in rap. Although I aspire, as a person who can promote cultural initiatives on my own, to push more social and political rap records, I get what's real, whatever is honest.
I know what you're saying, and I don't want to argue that all rap is gangster rap, because I know that that's not true. But on the other hand, I just wonder how you feel sometimes if you see an 8-year-old kid who's listening to rap and mouthing things that they don't even understand what it means about gangsters and bitches and hoes and guns and drugs.
Well, 8-year-old kids watch the news, ma'am. In all fairness, sometimes you say a sex record, is bad. Somebody says something about sex, but you turn on 6 o'clock and it's implied and it's shown all the time. Not the physical. I mean, certainly a record.
But I'm still asking you how you feel about it when you see it with rap. The kids just start to aspire to.
You're putting something on me that you don't put on the news, that you don't put on daytime television.
you wouldn't
you're
know.
You're putting a greater pressure on no. You're putting a greater pressure on these artists mm-hmm. than you are on daytime mainstream television. And these records do have parental advisory stickers on them. You watch violent movies, really violent movies, primetime. So I just think that, you know, this is kind of a racial thing to some degree. You know, it's like we don't like, maybe language bothers you. I'm not offended by language. I'm not too worried about my child hearing language. The ideas I'm concerned with, I will talk to my child about. But my child will see and hear these ideas everywhere.
The same questions have been asked about violent movies and a lot of television and so on. And I'm not myself trying to pass judgment here. I'm just asking you if you have ever been in the position of thinking, gee, somebody's taking the wrong message away from this. They're taking it too literally. They're taking it at face value. They're aspiring to a kind of street warfare that they're not forced into doing. I mean, they're not even...
Well, I certainly know that people take a lot of culture and a lot of reality and twist it the way it suits them, whether it's a James Cagney movie, an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, whether it's a rap record. But a lot of these kids, you know, they need counseling and parents to work with them and support in a different way. But there are so many influences on kids, so many positive and so many that could be made positive or made negative depending on where the kid's mindset is at that time. And I'm hopeful that more good will come from rap's description of the condition of the suffering people in the communities than bad. But I certainly don't, you know, believe that the artists are responsible for the actions of the people who buy their music.
One of the things that you have now is a fashion company, clothes and colognes. It's called Fat Farm. How long have you been in that end of things?
Well, that company is now celebrating, well, will be in spring, and we're working on a collection now for fall 2002. Will be a 10-year anniversary.
Was it that long?
That's right. And so Fat Farm is celebrating its 10-year anniversary. It's a pretty interesting story because when we started Fat Farm, there were no partners and no one really understood our vision. And we said in our first campaign, classic American flavor. And it was kind of a joke to a lot of the retailers, certainly the buyers from Bloomingdale's and Macy's. And they'd look, classic American flavor, what do you mean? I mean, if you have to think about the fact that Ralph Lipschitz had to change his name to be that. I mean, because obviously no Jew could be the American dream. And for me, classic American flavor, and there was not one black person owner in the entire Magic, which was a convention where you sell clothes. But classic American flavor and the kind of clothes that I aspired to sell didn't fit into what they referred to as an ethnic clothing division they were starting to develop. And that meant low expectations and limited budgets and a small, and the idea of an American company, I mean, so we couldn't sit next to the Ralphs or Polo or Tommy's, and that really was the case. And now, 10 years later, the company went last year from $140 to $220 million this year. And especially, as you know, this economy has slowed, and most companies have gone backwards or, you know, or still, but our company still grew a tremendous amount this year. Like I said earlier, there weren't any black companies, and there was no appreciation. They really thought that we had an ethnic clothing company. And I was like, what is that? I have pink Argyle sweaters. What is ethnic about our company? And it was just a lack. I mean, it's the same as I have an advertising agency, which represents Coca-Cola and Cavassier and many other companies. And they still say sometimes, well, we're an ethnic advertising company. I said, what does that mean? I'm an American. I've been born here my whole life. But there were many ethnic companies. There are many urban advertising companies. And that was all that was available at one time. In my film business, you know, there's not one film, black film producer. I was when I made Nutty Professor, and they pointed out to me that was the only black person who was a film producer not making urban films. Just like BET playing our videos. When MTV played our videos, it was like a you know, something brand new. So now rap, we've replaced ourselves. Right now, we have the number one record in America. But before this number one record in America, which is the DMX record, we replaced our own number one record, which was the Jay-Z record. And before that, we replaced our other number one record with the Ja Rule. And that's not the black chart. That's the American pop chart. 80% of my records are sold to non-African Americans. I don't look on the black chart anymore, although it still exists.
My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He has a new memoir called Life and Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He co-founded Def Jam Records, has produced movies and TV shows, and created the clothing and accessories company Fat Farm. In June of this year, there was a hip-hop summit that you helped organize. And I think one of the things that happened there was that you started a political action committee. What do you want to accomplish with it? What are the issues that you want to put across in Washington?
Well, one of the things that we do, and we're funded by the RIAA and the record industry and individual companies, independent companies, is protect us in Washington. As you remember, there was a real aggressive attack, which was newsworthy before September 11th, on hip-hop, whether it's Senator Lieberman's Marketing Accountability Act or the FCC suing radio stations, one for a poet and the other one for an Eminem record. They were suing radio stations over music. And the Marketing Accountability Act was something that threatened the very foundation of our freedom of speech and our music business. So, of course, we want to protect that industry. But also, we want to inspire a higher level of consciousness amongst many rappers. And so, at that summit, we talked, you know, Puffy and Wyclef and Mary J. Blige and Queen Latifah and Will Smith, and many rappers came. And we had meetings about A&R, which is the artist repertoire business of getting the truth out of artists in case there were some artists who were not only telling the truth but were, as you suggested earlier, talking more about the street than they were living. You know, talk about what your honest interpretation of life is. Give us the truth. It will sell more. So we had a seminar about that. We had another seminar about what we were going to do to address the Marketing Accountability Act, and that we all agreed at that time that we were going to make sure we not only label the records, but we make sure in radio and television ads that we would make it clear these records, some records, were parental advisory. And the third thing we did was we had a speech by Minister Louis Farrakhan, who was a big draw in the hip-hop community, as you know or don't know. And his speech was, I think, very inspirational to a lot of them. Kwasi and Fume from the NAACP came. Hugh Price from the Urban League came. Martin Luther King from the SCLC came. Cornel West and all the other intellectuals from you know, Michael Dyson and many other people came and participated. And the idea was to get the adults, because it was their job to reach out to the young people instead of turning their back. You have great organizations like the Urban League that have millions of dollars and great infrastructures that are not connected to the people in the community, or not to the young people in the community. And even Kwasi and Fume, who is a real advocate of working with young people, has had to fight his board of directors in order to use young people in the way that, to reach other young people. I remember when Ben Chavis, who now works for and is the president of the Hip Hop Action Network, was the president of the NAACP. And we did a Rap the Vote campaign with Run DMC. The people at the NAACP were furious. Said, why would you use these kids to reach these people?
Does it ever surprise you that you're not young yourself anymore? That, like, you've been in this business a long time, and you're in your what, mid-40s now?
That's right, I'm 44.
And it's such a kind of youth-oriented business, the whole hip-hop business. Yeah.
I think I feel young. I don't go to every party. I don't take drugs and go crazy. In fact, I'm a vegan. I don't even eat animals.
Uh-huh.
You know, or any animal product. I won't even eat a piece of fish. But I'm happy, and I don't judge what I've done or what young people do. You know, I think God shined on all of what you consider evil and even good. And I think what you're inspired to do, I have a very funny philosophy about judgment. A very strong opinion about judgment, although, you know, I just think let it be and, you know, and see what's good in it. And I think that I love young people. I love their spirit because they're able to see what's God in everyone much quicker than some of the older, mostly more rigid people. Young people, it's their job to lead us somewhere more positive. That's why I work so hard on Rap to Vote. That's why I work so hard to inspire young people to speak up, to pick up a newspaper, not only to destroy what their parents gave them, but to give them a new direction. So I love young people. I feel young mostly. I'm in better shape than I was 25 years ago. So I think I'm okay, and I don't feel too bad about it. In fact, I think that I love the place I am in my life right now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russell Simmons has a new memoir called Life and Deaf. His Deaf Poetry Jam series begins on HBO December 14th.